new generation of historians has taken on the story of the 60s. Declassification of government documents has enabled new interpretations of a story those of us who lived through it thought we knew. Jeremy Suri wrote a book called Power and Protest. He makes the case that a lot of the foreign policy of the 60s was a response to domestic unrest. And as he told Anne Strainchamps, this was a global phenomenon.
It's this moment when you have synchronized unrest in very diverse cultural societies. We tend to presume that cultural diversity means cultural separation. I think the 60s is an example of how cultural diversity also means cultural interconnection. It's amazing to me that you have Chinese students, Russian students, German, French, American, Mexican, Japanese students all going into the streets at the same time.
See, I didn't know that. And play some of that out, because, for instance, I think if you ask most Americans, were there any other student protests going on in the 60s, most of us might remember, say, France and the student protests in 1968. I don't remember a Russian student protest movement.
Well, what you have in these societies is, of course, differences in the kinds of movements, but there are major things happening. For example, in Russia, you have all kinds of informal student resistance that's occurring that the Soviet leadership is very, very conscious of. For example, Soviet students who refuse to join the mandatory youth league. There are all kinds of crises about that. Students who engage in public drunkenness on a scale that they didn't before. Now, you can say that's just young people being young people, but there's no doubt when you go back and look at the records of what these students are saying in their diaries and in their journals and things of that, that they're saying this is our way of protesting against the system. And what's most significant to me is that the Soviet leadership recognized it in those terms. There's all kinds of discussion within the KGB, within the Politburo, about how we're losing our youth.
So there was that same sense of an entirely new generation, that this was a generational difference and the youth were rebelling against authority.
Exactly. I think what cuts across these societies is that the leaders in these societies feel they're out of touch with the younger people at the very same time that they're hinging their ideologies on appealing to these young people. Well, I mean, what's curious is that Khrushchev and Kennedy are both saying we're going to mobilize our public and build real communism and build a new frontier, but the very people they hope to be speaking to are tuning them out.
Hmm. Where else besides the USSR and the U.S.?
China. There's a lot of there. China is, of course, a slightly different case in that the actual leadership, Mao himself, encourages students to rebel. The Red Guards are sort of following Mao's initial inspiration, but they quickly turn against him. There's a wonderful moment I describe when in 1967 he goes to meet with some of these Red Guards who he sees as his little red children, and his bodyguards tell him, "You better leave. You better just leave this town. They're going to turn against you very quickly. They've decided that they're against all authority, including your authority as well." So even in China, where there is more manipulation early on, even
well,
there...
Well, and in China is where we think of the social... The revolutionaries were state-sanctioned. That was Mao leading his Red Army.
Yes, but of course, when you're the state leader and you're orchestrating anti-state revolution, there's a certain point at which it goes a little too far, even for someone like Mao. And that's the interesting thing in 67, 68, when he's really forced to pull back. And he, like Lyndon Johnson, becomes a prisoner in his own state government. It's a really interesting thing. Mao is afraid to go out, just as Lyndon Johnson was afraid to go out anywhere because he'd be confronted by protesters.
So what you see happening in the 60s is the emergence of this kind of international language of dissent. Were the students at the time, the young people at the time, really aware of these global connections?
I think they were. I mean, what I argue in the book is that they were definitely aware that things were happening elsewhere. I'm amazed at how internationally aware many of these students were. It doesn't mean they were collaborating. I don't think that the connections in terms of planning and daily behavior were very strong across societies. But image mattered. Symbolism mattered. So one of the examples I like to look at is the role of the Prague Spring, which many people, this sort of movement toward socialism with a human face, led by young people in what is then Czechoslovakia in the early 1968, Americans, French students, German students don't really know too much about what's going on in detail, but the image of that as an alternative, as a third way, is very inspirational. Mm-hmm. And you find that rhetoric seeping into student activist activities in those other societies. The same is true for the Cultural Revolution. The best example there is France. The French students say, we are leading our own cultural revolution on the Chinese model.
What about the world's leaders? Do you think they saw this as a large, widespread global youth movement, or were they each so focused on their own domestic problems that they weren't looking at what was happening in other places?
I think they come very quickly to see this as a global problem, and this is a case where there is new material we didn't have before. While a lot of the material on the student activities, the newspapers, the posters, all the really fun stuff to read has been available for a long time, a lot of the government documents have only just become available the last 5 to 10 years because of classification issues. And what we find is that leaders talk very explicitly about this, even though they're from different countries, in the same way, as a global phenomenon. phenomenon. My favorite example, which I cite in the book at length, is the CIA report produced in March of 68 for Lyndon Johnson. He asked the CIA to address this issue. And they produce a report, first of all, that says it's not the communists who are behind this. I mean, you expect the CIA to say this is all about communists. But no, they say this is not a problem of communists. This is a problem of industrialized society and modernization. And the title of the report is Restless Youth Around the World. And the report is more than 100 pages, goes through all the major countries. And the conclusion it comes to is that what we face is not a problem of East versus West, but young versus old.
Wow. I get this picture of, I mean, were there ever world summits in which Khrushchev or Brezhnev and Nixon and Willy Brandt all sat down and said, "Ah, kids today."
Yes, actually. I mean, that's where I find this so exciting. My argument in the book is that detente, this period of, shall we say, softening Cold War rhetoric, more cooperation among traditional Cold War enemies, symbolized most by Nixon's trip to China in February 72 and then his trip to the Soviet Union in May 72, is all about this. When we read the minutes of what they actually said, in particular Nixon and Mao, they spend more time kvetching and complaining about the students than they do talking about strategic policy.
And they actually talked about this
absolutely.
Together,
one of
Mao
my favorite,
and Nixon?
One of my favorite moments is when Mao says to Nixon, "I would have voted for you if I could have. I like rightists." This is Mao saying this to Nixon. And then Nixon says to Mao, "Well, we both come from the same kind of place. We have our feet on the ground. And the problem is we just have students at home, young people." He says young people at home just don't understand politics. What grows up in the international system is a sense of identification between leaders who have opposite ideologies, men like Mao and Nixon who have spent their entire careers criticizing one another. They come together because they now see that they have more pressing problems at home, and they believe that since they're of the same generation, they can understand one another where their own students can't. Before Nixon goes to China, he makes this famous visit to the Lincoln Memorial late at night, and he tries to talk to the students there who are out there protesting Vietnam, and he gets nowhere. I mean, the students are amazed that he comes out to talk to them, but he gets them. He can't communicate. He's speaking a totally different language from them, but he can talk to Mao. He can talk to Brezhnev. And that's what changes. And to me, that's how this global set of student movements transformed international politics.
This is so interesting because the story about détente that we're usually told, the traditional narrative, is that it has everything to do with nuclear arms escalation, that it was a way of trying to, you know, prevent the U.S. and the USSR from blowing each other and the rest of the world up. This isn't how you see it?
Well, that's certainly part of it. I mean, these are not mutually exclusive things. There is a push at this point to manage the nuclear arms race, as the United States and the Soviet Union, first of all, have reached near parity. We can now blow each other up 80 million times, and that's about enough, people come to think. It's getting more and more expensive to do this. So it is about managing that. But what's amazing to me is how little is accomplished in that area and how little it comes up in conversations. I mean, let's be frank. Until the end of the 1970s and early 1980s, not a single nuclear weapon is destroyed as a result of any of these agreements. The only agreements they make are not to build some new things. But they don't actually reduce anything. It's just stabilization. It's much more about taking the existing status quo and protecting it against problems internally, students and others, and external problems, small states that are posing new kinds of risks.
What do you see as the lessons of this new history of the 60s for today, for student radical leaders today, for people who are protesting the Iraq War?
I see a number of lessons. The first, I think, is that it's important not to polarize politics in the way that a lot of activists did, as did politicians at the time. I think activists are most effective not when they're just storming the barricade, so to speak, but when they're also infiltrating and working through the institutions of government. And one of the mistakes that was made in the 1960s in all of these societies, and it was made because, in a sense, they weren't given many options, the students said, "We're going to renounce the existing political system. We're going to build a new one." One of the reasons
they should have all run for Congress instead?
Absolutely. I think, in not all of them, but they should have gotten more involved in politics. I think that they underrated the degrees to which, especially within a democratic society, a flawed democratic society, but nonetheless a democratic society, one can work within institutions to some extent. That wasn't an option for Soviet and Chinese citizens, but it was an option for American and German and French student activists. And I think more of that needs to be done. I think also people have to spend more time learning about politics. There was a remarkable naivete about a lot of the protesters, a wonderful idealism, but also a remarkable naivete about the workings of politics. Many were very good at articulating hard-hitting criticisms of existing policy, but not offering alternatives. And that's one of the things that left the door open for the Richard Nixons and others. It's almost as if the student protesters knew what they hated, didn't really know what they wanted at a certain level. And that's part of that's being young, right? Part of that's also not having enough knowledge about politics. And I see that being recreated today.
Well, I was going to ask, what kind of parallels do you see between our foreign policy situation today and the period of time in the 60s? I mean, do you see President Bush, for instance, and his decision to move into Iraq as very similar to decisions our presidents made in the 60s?
Well, there are certain similarities, of course, with the exertion of presidential power without the kind of popular support for what's being done. What's different, and the differences strike me more than the similarities, what's certainly different is there isn't any kind that I've seen of really organized young activism about this. I hear a lot of people complaining, and I hear some students and others also supportive of what's happening, but there isn't the kind of organized, passionate young activism. There are a lot of people out there like Michael Moore and others who are upset about what the president's doing, but there's nothing like a student movement about what's happening in Iraq. Students that I teach at the University of Wisconsin, students I see when I lecture around the country, are very curious and interested in what's happening, but they're not passionately and personally engaged in any kind of political movements. They're very apolitical.
Jeremy Suri is a historian at the University of Wisconsin. His book is called Power and Protest: Global Revolution and the Rise of Détente.